Chocolate. John and I actually worked in the same bookshop for a few years in Torquay, and this is my little advertisement. The best bookshop on the Bellarine Peninsula is the Torquay Bookshop. The best toy shop in the Bellarine Peninsula is the Torquay Toy Shop. And for all us wealthy, indulgent grandparents, they have some beautiful toys. But take your checkbook. Anyway, back to John. John began his career in writing in 2000, and his features, stories, essays were soon published in The Age, the Sydney Morning Herald, the Canberra Times, the Australian, Good Weekend, as well as a number of other Australian newspapers and magazines. His human rights work with poor tenant farmers in the Philippines confirmed his fascination with the world of outsiders, of people who feel they don't quite fit into the normal society. His first novel, Towards a Distant Sea, set in the Philippines of the 1970s, was published in 2005. Currently, an adaptation of this story, Beyond a Distant Sea, is under consideration by a Los Angeles producer as a potential miniseries. I just finished reading Towards a Distant Sea and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It left a lot of questions though that one day I'll ask John about. Much of his early published writing dealt with asylum seekers, religion and gay sexuality, or according to former High Court Judge Michael Kirby, his stories are about the impact of repression on the human spirit and the way, despite all odds, humanity struggles endlessly against worldly authority. John has taught professional and creative writing at Deakin University and has interviewed both local and overseas writers, particularly at Adelaide Writers Week and Melbourne Writers Festival. In 2009, he self-published All Mortal Flesh, a collection of stories exploring characters with all the frailties and quirkiness of the human condition. The hallmark of these stories, according to one commentator, was their compassionate lack of sentimentality. They have the sophisticated smoothness of a writer who is in command of his art. There is a raw honesty about them that never degenerates into... I can't read that word, John.
Better leave it out then.
Yes, and the balance between morality and mortality, or perhaps it's humanity and humanism, is maintained with a wisely observant eye. His second novel, Estuary, set partly in the Coorong at the Murray Mouth, was released in October 2013 and is about a search for identity through discovery of the past. It questions the dichotomies. That proves I'm a reader. I don't listen. Dichotomies that are often artificially constructed between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australians, between ideas of sanity and madness, identifications of sexuality, and considerations of deformity and wholeness. Estuary is the story of Seth, the woodcarver, and his aunt Lila, an artist who, while incarcerated in a mental hospital, develops a deep friendship with a young Aboriginal woman, Ruby. The twists of this story go beyond Seth's personal history and symbolise the complex relationships that are being played out currently in Australia. According to author Tony Birch, Estuary is a story told with heart and a true sense of tenderness. Reviewer Angela Yin called Estuary a beautiful story, a complex novel, and an illuminating yet heartbreaking ride. It's my pleasure to introduce John Bartlett.
Thank you so much, Maggie, for that introduction when it sounds like you were talking about somebody else, someone I hardly recognised. I'd like to thank you for inviting me here today and also to start off by acknowledging that we meet on the land of the traditional Wathaurong people and to pay tribute to them, to their ancestors and also to their current leaders. My talk today is, I guess I wanted to sort of talk about where writers come from. Do they sort of suddenly appear out of nowhere as these strange, mysterious creatures? Or are they like everybody else, they just have to basically learn their skill, and with lots of practice and lots of failure, somehow come out the end as sort of writers. And I think that's how writers are formed. They're not sort of special people, really. Except perhaps that we're born with a certain sort of fascination with people's stories and a fascination with words and how words sort of get put together. But then, from then on, it's just hard work, really. I think they say about 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration, which is probably really like most jobs anyway. I've titled my talk, Where Do Writers Come From? And I realised as I put that sort of slide up there that you'll think that, okay, writers come from the estuary. Now, estuary is really there because estuary was the title of my last book. But I do actually come from estuary because I actually come from Brimley, which is actually an estuary just down the coast. So in a sense, that's where I do come from. But what I wanted to talk about today was to sort of bore you a little bit with my own background and where my own sort of life story perhaps sort of was the beginning of my writing and how it sort of fed all my ideas on writing and made me perhaps unexpectedly a writer that I sort of didn't actually intend to be. I didn't sort of set out to be, I just sort of set out to do other things and then eventually became a writer. So I will bore you by just going back a little bit to my own background, the beginnings, which is my background in Murray Bridge in South Australia, where I grew up on the Murray. You'll see there the bridges, the old bridges of Murray Bridge, which you don't actually go over anymore. If you're heading to Adelaide now, you go over the Swanport Bridge, the new bridge, and you can pretty much just miss Murray Bridge altogether if you care to. But Murray Bridge was where I grew up as a child, and where my own family, I'll say a little bit about it because it does have quite an influence on estuary, on that sort of story. My great-grandfather, my great-great-grandfather actually settled in Murray Bridge way back in the beginning when it was just being settled, and that's relevant to the story. My father had a mechanic business, a garage in Murray Bridge, and my mother was a nurse, and we sort of were very much sort of part of that sort of Murray Bridge community. This was my great-great-grandfather who settled there originally, and I'll say more about him in a minute, and my family. Those pictures are taken from the from my own website, which I wasn't able to show you today, but sort of give some background to that too particular story. So Murray Bridge and the Murray, I think you'll probably all agree that the sort of area that we grew up in as children play a big part in our lives. I don't know if you do, but sort of thinking back to our own childhood and that landscape of where we grew up in plays a really big part in, I suppose, the mythology and the story of our lives. And I don't know about you, but in my mind I sort of often keep going back to Murray Bridge and thinking about the Murray and the 1956 flood and all those sort of stories around the Murray and my own father who rescued a boy from drowning in the Murray and all those sort of stories that I'm sure are part of your own family story too that somehow later feed into your life and in my case sort of feed into my stories. So I grew up in Murray Bridge in a very Catholic household and I went to a Catholic school there. And then pretty much soon because of that sort of Catholic background, I went to Catholic seminary. And believe it or not, that's me looking very sort of innocent and pure and as a Catholic seminarian. And I studied for the priesthood for 7 years, studied philosophy and theology in Sydney. And it was very much sort of part of the church set up there. And then pretty much after that, when I got my first appointment, I ended up in the Philippines. The Philippines in the 1970s was a pretty interesting place to be. There's just a couple of pictures of myself with long hair and a beard in those days. I can't recognise myself. Like, I'm sure you look back on pictures of your own childhood and that, you sort of think, oh, I have changed a little bit, haven't I? And also a picture of a family that I knew in the Philippines. So the Philippines was a very interesting place to be in the 1970s. Just as I was on the boat sort of going up to the Philippines, President Marcos, who was the president then, declared martial law because he was really wanting to stay in power and he was trying to find a way of sort of keeping himself in power. I'm sure you know about his famous wife, Imelda Marcos, and her shoe collection. Probably the thing we sort of remember most about the Marcoses. But they were a pretty corrupt family and they did some pretty bad things in the Philippines. But in order to sort of stay in power, he declared martial law. And that was, you know, a way of sort of keeping control over the country. I lived in the very southern part of the Philippines in an island called Mindanao, which was interesting because there were two things happening there at that time. There was a civil war against the communist New People's Army, and there was also a Muslim uprising, which it's a bit different to sort of what we're understanding now about Islam and Muslim sort of terrorists. It wasn't really like that, because Mindanao, the very southern part of the Philippines, despite the fact that the rest of the Philippines were Catholic and became Catholic under the Spanish, when the Spanish went there and took over the islands, but Mindanao was quite different because historically it was actually settled by Muslim people. So it was very much Muslim. But then the Catholics from the north were sort of running out of land, so they came down to the south and tried to sort of push their way into Mindanao and taking the land of the Muslims, really. So what was happening when I was there was that the Muslims were sort of trying to hang on to their land. There was an independence movement, which is quite different to sort of what we're sort of seeing now. So as an innocent, liberal, Catholic young person from country South Australia, suddenly I was dropped into the middle of this island of Mindanao where there was a war, two wars raging, and where there were all these sorts of different things happening. So it really turned my life around. It sort of changed me as a person. And even though in the church we were sort of doing lots of religious things, the normal things that you do in religion, church services and stuff like that, and walking up to the mountains and walking for 5 hours and doing 50 christenings and 10 weddings sort of in one day, there was all that. But at the same time, the church there was involved in social issues. And the group that I was very much involved in was what was called the Federation of Free Farmers. Because the farmers there were sort of set in the old sort of traditional system where they were under landlords who pretty much owned their lives and, you know, treated them as slaves. So the church was very much involved in trying to help those people see that they had rights and that it wasn't right that their children were dying of hunger because they were being used by their landlords. So I became very much involved in that, and because Marcos was sort of still trying to keep control of the country, he saw anything like that as being against the security of the country. So anyone involved in that sort of work was regarded as being subversive. That was the word that I used. So we in the church there sort of came under a lot of threat from the military and were often intimidated by the military. I remember one Sunday I was giving a sermon in the church around the time when Marcos wanted to continue martial law and was pushing a referendum to get people to actually vote yes for him to continue. And we were trying to put across to the people the idea that they had choices. They could vote yes, but they could vote no as well. And that wasn't going down very well with the military. So in the middle of the sermon, I remember on the Sunday when I was trying to sort of point that out to the people, two truckloads of military people came into the church. They drove outside and they positioned themselves all around the side of the church during the sermon with their guns. So it was a pretty sort of intimidating sort of situation. And it was okay for me because I was a foreigner, so I could sort of pick up any day and just go home. But for the Filipino people, it was really life and death for them. And I have to say they still now, you know, recognise the courage of those Filipino people. They're wonderful people, just absolutely wonderful. Even people who are sort of living in, you know, dire poverty, very generous and very kind and loving and full of life and fun. I'll never sort of forget them and forget the courageous people that that I met during that time in the Philippines. Okay, so I was there between 1971 and 1980. And as I said, you know, a very important time in my life. Then there was after the church. I came back to Australia in 1980 and I left the church, I left the priesthood, and I embarked on a number of sort of different careers. Also at the same time, I came out as a gay man, which was a big change for me. I don't know if any of you have got gay children or gay grandchildren, but it's something that was sort of part of something I was struggling with in the Philippines and something that, you know, I had to do when I came out. And happy to say now I'm in a been in a relationship for 31 years, which I can hardly believe, a very happy relationship, so I was very fortunate. When I came out of the church, I didn't know what to do. I had no training. I mean, it was a bit like being in prison. If you went for a job, you know, people would say, well, where were you for the last 10 years? It's like, you know, you've been behind bars. So my first job was as a kitchen hand in Melbourne and chopping up vegetables and washing saucepans. And it might sound like a big change from what I'd been used to, but it was a big relief. It was nice just to do something sort of very simple, and I rode my bike from St Kilda into the city every day and did that, and I just enjoyed sort of perhaps not being in the position where I was in the Philippines, which was that the priest was up on a pedestal and was holier than thou, and people sort of looked up to him and expected. I found that a sort of very difficult position. So being a kitchen hand was a lot of fun. And there was the top of Collins Street Towers from the kitchen up there, and we had all these important people used to come in for lunch. I remember Bob Hawke came in one time, and must have been the time when he was not drinking, and I tried to pour him a beer, I remember that day, and he sort of slapped my hand away and said something rude about, you know, he wasn't drinking anymore. So had all those sorts of exciting sort of people to see. I also worked as a film extra in Melbourne, which was also a lot of fun. You might have seen me on Cop Shop, if any of you remember Cop Shop. I was in the crowd somewhere in the background and quite a few other sort of things, and that was a lot of fun too. I enjoyed that very much. I worked as a funeral attendant for one day. I found that sort of a bit too full on, so I only lasted one day, unfortunately. My life then was a series of short, sharp careers, I guess. I worked as a waiter too. I worked as a masseur. I worked as a community development worker on the housing estates in Northcote in Melbourne. And I saw a lot of poverty there and a lot of disadvantage too. People sort of in poverty and unemployed and on drugs and getting into fights and all that sort of thing. So that sort of reawakened my interest probably in, you know, people and their disadvantage. And then sort of eventually by the time I came to Geelong, I went back to university and I did an arts degree and I did an MA in arts, and then through that I actually got work teaching at Deakin as a university tutor. What next? Okay, so then in 2000 I sort of realised that the one thing I hadn't done, the thing that, you know, I'd be sort of sad not to have done if I got hit by a tram tomorrow, was that I'd never actually done anything about my interest in writing. It was always there in the background, but, you know, I'd never had the opportunity or given myself the chance. So in 2000 I went to the Gordon Institute in Geelong's professional writing and editing course, and that was a fantastic course. That sort of just gave me such enthusiasm and started to give me the skills I needed to be a writer. So I finished their professional writing and editing course, and I started writing sort of at the same time, and was surprised that I was starting to get published. And a couple of articles there that I just sort of showed, one that appeared in the Good Weekend about my aunt, and that was sort of irrelevant later when I talk about estuary, and a number of others in The Age and that too. And those were the days when you could actually, as a freelance, you could actually approach all those editors, The Age, The Herald Sun, the whatever the newspaper, the Geelong Addy, whatever they were, and they'd actually read your work and consider it. And that's all changed now, of course, because their own people are sort of losing their jobs, so they don't really look at freelancers anymore, so that's changed totally. So I was very lucky to sort of have that experience and to build that up, that sort of profile. Then I published my first book, which Maggie talked about, Towards a Distant Sea. When I came back from the Philippines, I had all these stories in my head about the Philippines, but I wasn't sure what to do with them. So I sort of, each of them were sort of separate little stories, and then I realised after a while that I had, you know, 20 or 30 little separate stories, that perhaps they were a collection of short stories. And then I decided to put them together as a novel, Towards a Distant Sea. So this is the story. This is not autobiographical in the sense that, okay, it's based on a young Australian priest who goes to the Philippines during 1970s under martial law. But I didn't want to make it autobiographical because I wanted to use lots of other stories of lots of other people too, and just, you know, sort of churn them all up and sort of put them out as one particular story. So this is the Towards a Distant Sea story. Then in 2009, as Maggie also said, I had a number of sort of, was still writing lots of short stories, and I enjoyed that sort of being able to, you know, do a short story fairly quickly and easily. And some of them were getting published in magazines and some of them won competitions. So I decided to put them all together into All Mortal Flesh, a collection of short stories in 2009. I was just looking at the titles this morning and realising that they came from all over the place. They came from some of my own experiences, stories that people had told me, something I'd read in the newspaper, all over. So that where stories sort of come from writers, they can come from everywhere, but they just sort of, it's like putting them in a blender and turning on the blender and they come out as something else at the other side. You know, they're not just the facts of the story. We sort of like to invent and add stuff and make up stuff and sort of turn out something sort of completely different. So that was All Mortal Flesh. And then my most recent novel, Estuary, which was published in 2013. But just say a little bit about the influences of that, because There are a couple of influences in my background. My growing up in Murray Bridge and being part of that sort of family who'd settled in the area for many, many years. My great-grandfather's story was that he came to Murray Bridge, you know, in very early days, and he became very successful in cutting down lots of trees and making a lot of money out of selling timber. And also he set up a quarry along the banks of the Murray for sandstone. And he sold a lot of sandstone to, just at the time in Adelaide, they were building lots of the major buildings in Adelaide. And he sold the stone to Adelaide. If you know the railway building in Adelaide, that was built by stone from my great-grandfather's quarry. So, sort of reflecting on his life, I realised that he'd done damn well from, you know, living off the land and cutting down the trees and doing things like that. But I also reflected that, as a result, the people who'd been living there, the Nurradjeri people who'd been living along the Murray, had been disadvantaged and displaced by what my great-grandfather had achieved. So I started to sort of see how my own family had been part of that sort of influence and had sort of destroyed some of their lives and destroyed their culture. Not in a guilty sort of way, but just in a way of acknowledging that that was how things were. The other part of my story was the story of my aunt that influenced me to add to this story. My mother's sister, who was an artist and a music teacher, not successful, but none of us in the family are very successful, but we do what we do. But she was an artist and she was a musician and quite talented, I think. But what happened along the way was that she suffered from a mental illness and she was incarcerated in the mental institution in Adelaide, in the hospital there. She received ECT treatment and heavy drug treatment. And as a child, I saw her change totally. She became a totally changed person. She stopped painting, she stopped teaching, you know, her life was sort of completely turned around, really. And I always sort of thought, you know, if she'd been born at a different time, probably, and her illness had been understood differently, she probably would have had, you know, a more successful and creative life and lived sort of differently. And I always thought that, you know, her story needed to be told because she was, you know, a very talented person and somebody who should be remembered. And just as a corollary to that, that earlier story I showed you that was published in The Good Weekend, a couple of days after that story about her life was published, I had a phone call from the editor at Good Weekend and said that she'd been contacted by somebody in Sydney who wanted to talk to me. And said, yeah, sure. So this person rang from Sydney and said they were so surprised to read that story because she had been a pupil of my aunt's in Adelaide. And not only that, but because of my aunt's teaching, getting goosebumps now, just talking about it. Because of my aunt's wonderful teaching, she became a musician and a composer herself, and that she would never have done that if it hadn't been for my aunt's teaching. Mm. So I thought, right, you know, her life was validated in one form or another. So her story became sort of part of this story, and I even went to the Glenside Hospital in Adelaide, and I got all her records, and I incorporated some of them into this story. So I sort of mixed all those bits together, the story of my great-grandfather and my aunt, and that's the story of Seth, who goes back to Adelaide for his aunt's funeral, and through that he meets the Aboriginal friends of his aunt, and he starts to sort of then understand perhaps the history of his family and what's happened, and his own sort of, how his own identity is sort of formed by that too. So that's where that came from. What's happening now, current projects, I'll just sort of say quickly, that Towards a Distant Sea was picked up by a little movie, boutique movie place in Sydney, and they wanted to change it to talking about making it into a film or a TV miniseries. So what's happened now is that it's been considered, it has been looked at by a producer in Los Angeles who really likes the idea, but what they wanted to do was to call it Beyond a Distant Sea. So the character from Towards a Distant Sea is now much older and they're living in America, but the same sort of character. It's a sort of a private eye sort of person, really, living in Venice Beach near Los Angeles. And so at the moment that's being developed, and they're just some takes from the website. They've actually done a little video of the film, like a preview of the film, and put together, you know, lots of sort of bits and pieces. It's currently been rewritten for that. So it's under development by Ink to Screen, is the name of the company, under consideration by the producer. It's being rewritten at the moment as a TV project because obviously it's different to a book. A book is different to a TV miniseries. And I've written the first draft of the book version too at this stage, so I'm not quite sure where it's going to go. Sounds exciting, and I never sort of expected to get that far, but of course it's got a long way to go, so I'm just excited that it's got that far. If it doesn't happen, that's all right. I just never expected it would get that far, really. And Jack Thompson was agreed to sort of be the face of, at the moment, I don't know whether he's going to be part of the project, but he agreed to be sort of the promotional face for that story. And then also Estuary is being considered by the same people as a potential film too. So they've also done a little preview film for that. That hasn't advanced to very far yet, and I'm not sure how that's going to go, but it's potentially is a... So now just a couple of stills from the video that's on my website as a potential movie. And the last thing probably to say is that I also sort of blog, if you know what blogging is, which is just writing a piece and putting them online, quite regularly on human rights issues, religion, politics. I guess because, as Maggie sort of read in my CV at the beginning, my experience in the Philippines sort of really just turned my life around and made me sort of interested and concerned about people who live on the edge, who don't have all the advantages that we have, and that, you know, writing about these things is about all I can do. It doesn't sort of change the situation too much, but I'm quite involved in writing about asylum seeker policy and very unhappy with the Labor and the Liberal policies on asylum seekers at the moment. And lots of other sorts of human rights issues, you know, concern me. So I write quite regularly, and that's my website that I particularly write at the moment. So I guess life goes on, and I hope to keep on writing until I fall off the twig, really. It's one of those things. It's not like plumbing or concreting or something you have to give up at a certain age. You can sort of keep on going. So while it still excites me, and it does excite me and energise me, I hope it's something that, you know, I'll certainly keep doing. So thank you very much for your attention. I don't know if there are any questions.
That
people
have. Questions for John?
John, did you have trouble getting your first book published? Was that a hassle?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was difficult. I suppose I did what most people do, is you send it out to all the big publishers and think, you know, oh, they're going to fall over themselves to sort of get to you. And of course, there was silence or rejection, and lots and lots and lots and lots of rejection. But someone told me one time that every rejection letter that you get brings you closer to actually being accepted. So you just, at some stage, you just have to be patient and wait. And but then I sort of thought about it more and thought I was probably targeting the wrong publishers. So I did a bit more research and I found a publisher, Indra Publishing, who don't publish anymore. I think my book was their last book. I don't know what that says. But they write particularly about Southeast Asia. They're interested in that, so I sort of was better at targeting, I guess. But it took me a while to sort of learn that.
What were the years of your aunt's life? What decades was she alive?
Well, she was born, I think, in... she died in 1972. I think she was born in... 1902, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. So that part, 70s, up to 72 anyway.
Yes. So did she die in the place where she was?
No, she didn't. She sort of went through times where she kept on going back to the hospital and being retreated, but in the end...
She took herself back, did she?
Not particularly, no, with my mother's sort of help, I think, she did, and the family sort of insistence that she took herself back. But she ended up in a nursing home with support from the family and that. But I always thought sort of quite sadly, really, because she never sort of quite expressed her potential, I guess.
Yes, and she had quite a lot of her abilities destroyed by the sound of things.
Her personal abilities?
Yes.
I think so, yes, yeah. She got to a certain time in her life, because she must have been a good musician and teacher.
Yes.
But that sort of really she had to stop.
Creative.
She was very creative,
yes.
Yeah.
She lost that.
And I think, you know, I always like to think that, you know, certain later, if it was now, she'd be better understood. you know, and she'd be treated differently perhaps and probably gone on to have sort of quite a creative life. And I think that is possible now.
Hopefully,
yeah.
Have you been able to keep abreast of Mindanao and the things that are going on there at the time?
Yes, a little bit. Probably not as much as I should. I've sort of lost contact with most of the people I knew there. I suppose the thing I have noticed is that I talked about sort of what was then the Muslim independence movement has sort of changed. And there is, I understand, there's an organisation now called Abu Sayyaf, which is actually an Islamic terrorist group.
Yes.
And they've been very active in kidnapping people and holding them for ransom. So it seems like, you know, the situation certainly hasn't improved, it's probably got worse. Yes.
I was interested when you gave the name of the hospital that your aunt was there.
Yes.
Being treated. My great aunt Sue, my mother's aunt, was at the Home for Incurables.
Oh yes.
And when I was a young woman, I thought, oh, what a name.
Terrible name, isn't it?
Yes.
No. Yes.
You know, she was just a sick older lady.
That's right. Yes.
And I thought, my God, because my mother was from Adelaide, from Prospect.
Oh yes.
And so I have quite a bit of contact with South Australia.
There was something, I mean, I suppose it took us a while to learn that sort of labelling was so destructive, wasn't it? To call the hospital for the incurables was terrible. Yeah. Oh, well, and even, I mean, the hospital that my aunt was in, I think, was called, as commonly lots of places were, the asylum, you know, which was terrible, terrible sort of. You know, our understanding certainly has changed quite a lot since then.
Are dreadful.
That's right, yes.
No, well, our family went right up to Oruro.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes.
So it was, you know, very spread out.
Yes, yeah.
Very arid land, a lot of it.
Very, very arid, yeah. Any other questions?
Any more questions? Yes.
No, it's all right. I've got Maggie Swain.
Can I just mention about the books for sale?
Oh, yes, please do.
I do have copies of my books for sale, just by the door, so you can't escape. Anyway. Thank you very much for having me.
I'd recommend Towards a Distant Sea. It's got lots in it. My brain has really gone today. The Philippines aspect of it, the aspect of a young seminary being sent from Australia to this completely, well, foreign country, really was a foreign country. And the people in it, there's quite a few really good characters in here that I enjoyed. And I'm looking forward to reading Estuary, because I love books that are set in places that I know, and I know South Australia and that area, so it's one of my passions. John, thank you very much for coming and talking. It was really interesting, and on behalf of Probus, we'd like to give you a little gift. John is coming to lunch with us, so if anyone wants to have a talk, maybe we've got some budding writers in the group that want their diaries, their secret passions of Molly Meldrum or something like that. With that age, Molly Meldrum. Written down, maybe you can talk to John. Thank you.